On the evening of September 18, 1980, at a Titan II missile complex in Damascus, Arkansas, a worker accidentally dropped a socket, puncturing the fuel tank of an intercontinental ballistic missile that carried the most powerful nuclear warhead in our arsenal. The feverish efforts during the 9 years that followed to avoid a deadly explosion, 600 times more powerful than Hiroshima, are the subject of Command and Control, a documentary thriller directed by Robert Kenner, co-written by Eric Schlosser. It opens this Wednesday at Film Forum on West Houston Street, and it brings both Robert Kenner and Eric Schlosser back to our show. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Eric, wasn't this a big news story at the time? How is it that the story of the Damascus accident is so little known now?
It was a big news story for about 3 days. And the Pentagon was very effective at denying there was any possibility of a nuclear detonation. There was a lot of other news stories. There were hostages in Iran. There was a presidential campaign. So it was forgotten. The press accepted the assertion that there was never any danger of a detonation, and we now know that was a lie.
Did they have, the press have no choice but to believe what it was being told, or did they drop the ball?
I think that during the Cold War, there was such intense secrecy around the subject of nuclear weapons that even many people within the government had no way of knowing that we had a nuclear arsenal that was nowhere near as safe as it needed to be.
Are you telling pretty much the same story that you told in your book of the same name?
Yeah, the film is based on the book, and it uses the same central narrative, but the film is much more focused. It really is a thriller, an attempt to do a nonfiction documentary, minute-by-minute, ticking-clock thriller, and the book had that aspect to it, but it had a great deal of history and many more diversions, and I think Robbie has just really cut it down to its essence and tried to make something that's compelling from the first minute to the last.
Well, the visuals, Robert, really are kind of very compelling, yeah, to use the same word, but there are all sorts of other words like scary. Can you give us a brief synopsis of what happened?
Yeah, well, talking about the visuals for a second, we collected all the footage that, you know, one could find, and we had the Clinton Library in Arkansas helping us, and there was some footage of, obviously footage of training of the missileers, and there was some footage from out in Arkansas, and some footage from the aftermath of the accident. But we, I'd read Eric's book. I thought this was an amazing subject, but I wasn't sure how to turn it into a film until I found out that we had access to the only Titan II missile silo in the world, which is a museum outside of Tucson, Arizona. And we got access to the silo, and it's exactly the period that the accident took place in. So we were able to bring this accident to life.
And they were perfectly willing to have you shoot a film that is quite critical of the American military in that museum?
It took us a little while we had Air Force personnel doing interface with us, and they grew to like us. And then the woman who ran the museum was cautiously allowing us in. But by the end, she allowed us to put drones in the silo. So we actually, some of those incredible shots are a drone going up 12 stories with cameras, and it's 4 feet between the wall and the missile. And she allowed us to start to blow things up around there. And she brought her own fire trucks in and was very supportive.
I think there was also a recognition that an injustice had been done to some of the young men who served in the military. And
a few of whom died.
And really risked, I mean, it sounds so corny, but that's one of the reasons why it's such an extraordinary story. We're talking about, you know, dozens of young men in their late teens and early 20s who risked their lives to try to prevent a nuclear detonation on American soil. And the real criticism ultimately lies with some of the higher level people in the military bureaucracy who, in covering up the accident and in covering up the causes of the accident, were willing to place the blame wrongly on these young airmen who, you know, rushed. We were just talking about it earlier, but the day after 9/11, you know, I was in New York City on 9/11. I went down there and I saw the most extraordinary heroism I've ever seen of people rushing into a dangerous situation while other people were running away from it. That was exactly the same thing that was happening in Damascus, Arkansas, you know, September 18th, 1980, in which they evacuated this site, and then there were certain people who put on these special outfits to try to go into this missile silo, rescue the missile, try to prevent an explosion that could have wiped out the state and much of the eastern seaboard.
I'm talking about a new film called Command and Control, which will open at the Film Forum on West Houston Street on Wednesday with Eric Schlosser, who is the co-author. It's based on his book, and also Robert Kenner, who directed and also wrote. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You have opened up so many different things that I don't know how to follow up, but let's go back to the beginning. There are these two airmen, David F. Powell and Jeffrey L. Plum, who were performing routine maintenance on the Titan II silo. Were they experienced missile technicians? They were just kids, weren't they?
Well, you know, what's remarkable about the Cold War, and it's still true today, is the people who are doing the maintenance on our nuclear weapons and weapon systems are kids. That's how the military works. They're 22, 23. Some of them can be as young as 18. And they're able to do the job because there are checklists that tell you exactly how to do each operation. In the case of that evening in Damascus, Arkansas, Powell was relatively experienced and considered quite good at his job, but Plum was essentially a trainee. He was getting what they call on-the-job training about how to service this missile. And the problem with having these sorts of young guys handling the most dangerous weapons ever made is the checklist is great until something goes wrong. And the minute that something goes wrong, there may not be a checklist to deal with the problem at all. And that was really what happened at Damascus.
Yes.
Nothing like this had ever happened before.
But that's also true of people. Age is not the factor. The fact is, once you get off the checklist, no one knows what to do.
As they stood on the platform near the top of the rocket, a socket fell from Powell's wrench, dropped 70 feet, and punctured the missile. And then a stream of highly explosive rocket fuel began pouring into the silo. Did they have any idea of what might happen as a result?
Well, as Powell said, uh-oh, when it happened. And they instantly knew. They said it was a million-to-one shot that socket could fall and hit the missile, though when we were there, we dropped sockets numerous times, and we hit the missile six times out of 12.
Was there a fear that it might lead to an explosion that would launch the rocket, sending a nuclear warhead up into the air and landing somewhere nearby?
There was an immediate fear that there could be a massive explosion of just the fuels in the missile, and then there was the unknown what would happen to the warhead.
How powerful was the nuclear warhead?
It was the most powerful warhead that we ever built. It was 9 megatons. And by as a way of comparison, all of the explosions in the Second World War combined, including both atomic bombs, were less than 3 megatons. So this one weapon had more explosive force than all the bombs that went off during the Second World War.
And you note that it could have totally destroyed much of Arkansas and deposit lethal radioactive fallout across the whole East Coast. It also might have changed the course of American presidential history, because President Carter and a future president, Bill Clinton, were both in Little Rock, not far from the missile site.
Carter was at the White House, but Mondale was in Arkansas, but Bill Clinton was the governor of the state at that point. It's one of those could-have-been things, but it could have changed the course of history. I mean, you think what happened just after, you know, 9/11 versus this sort of nuclear catastrophe.
It's one of these situations where they're long shots. They're very improbable. The odds of one of these missiles going off, or one of the warheads going off, rather, is very improbable. But if it does, it's one of those things where everyone's going to say, why didn't we deal with it before? And that's what made me want to go make the film, was the sense that we've stopped thinking about these missiles today. We've stopped thinking about these warheads and these incredibly powerful weapons that we have. And there's a certain amnesia that's taken over.
Well, it seems from what you say that mistakes, accidents, technical glitches are fairly common in the Defense Department. And there are a number of cases that you cite here. Didn't the Air Force lose control of a half dozen nuclear weapons for a day and a half as recently as 2007?
They did. And what was really scary about that incident is there was such a breakdown in procedures at every level. I mean, the ground crew person removing the nuclear weapons for the bunker didn't realize they were nuclear weapons. Nobody was required to sign for the nuclear weapons when they were removed. He took them past a checkpoint. Nobody checked to see if they were nuclear weapons. They were loaded onto a bomber. The pilot of the bomber is always supposed to check the munitions before taking off. And then the plane was flown halfway across the United States and left on a runway unguarded until some other workers came by and realized, oh my gosh, there are nuclear weapons on this plane. There have continued to be accidents. The most recent one was in May of 2014. There were some workers working on a Minuteman missile in a silo in Colorado, and we don't know exactly what the details were, but they did something wrong. Another team was called in, and that team significantly damaged this missile. Now, the Associated Press is suing under the Freedom of Information Act to find out what happened, but that's a significant accident 2 years ago in Colorado.
And didn't 50 Minuteman missiles go offline suddenly in 2010? Is anything being done to assure that these weapons can't be hacked?
It's a subject of enormous concern. 50 missiles, each one with a powerful nuclear warhead, suddenly went out of communication with their launch control centers. And nothing like this had happened. They traced the cause back to a single circuit board that had been improperly installed, but it raised the possibility that somebody could hack into the nuclear command and control system. Anytime an accident happens with one of these systems, you have to assume someone could also deliberately do something like that.
But even if it isn't deliberate, we're talking about very powerful weapons and we have things improperly installed. That's scary.
It's scary.
When Americans are polled about important problems facing the nation, the threat of nuclear war or a nuclear accident doesn't even come up.
Yeah, it's an invisible, it's almost like an amnesia that's taken over. And, you know, when I was growing up, I remember hiding under desks to protect myself from nuclear weapons.
It wouldn't have helped, you know that.
Yes. Actually, the designers of the weapons who are in the film said that they had bomb shelters up through the 50s and then began to realize they would be much more practical as wine cellars because the bomb shelters would do no good at all. But, you know, and in the 80s, there was a large anti-nuke movement that really moved Reagan and Gorbachev to rethink it and to cut down on our weapons. But today, we just don't, you know, we prefer not to think about it.
But you mention in the film, I think it's a surprise to many people, that the two presidents who did the most to cut our nuclear weapons arsenal were the two presidents Bush.
Yeah. It's incredible. The Bush Sr., George H.W. Bush, really was quite good on this issue. And when it looked like the Soviet Union was collapsing, he just unilaterally removed nuclear weapons from Europe, took our bombers off of alert, and our arsenal was cut in half while George H.W. Bush was president. And then the size was cut in half again when George W. Bush was president. And it may be one of those unfortunate things of, like, only Nixon can go to China, but both of these Republican presidents were responsible for huge cuts in our arsenal, where President Obama, who I think is wonderful on this issue and sincerely wants to abolish nuclear weapons, has had great difficulty working with Congress to continue to bring the numbers down.
My guests are Eric Schlosser, who wrote the book Command and Control, now made into a documentary by Robert Kenner. The film opens this Wednesday at the Film Forum on West Howson Street, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with a look at a new documentary thriller called Command and Control, directed by Robert Kenner, co-written by Eric Schlosser, who are my guests now. Can you explain the title?
Command and Control is a military phrase, and it's about the ability for a commander to tell his forces what to do and ensure that those instructions are carried out. So it's a process of not only giving an order, but being able to communicate back to the field and learn what's going on there. It's a process of command. And one of the themes of my book and of this film is the illusion of control. We create all these systems. They're ingenious systems. They're ingenious technologies. And yet someone dropping a wrench can undo it all. In the book, there's one story of a guy bringing some rubber seat cushions onto a B-52 bomber for a long flight. The seat cushions are placed next to a heat vent. The heat vent sets the cushions on fire. The bomber crashes with nuclear weapons and almost destroys one of our most important military bases. When I was thinking about Robbie's film, Strangelove, is sort of the dark comedy, the dark nightmare comedy about this subject. And Robbie has made a classic thriller in which some little tiny event, the dropping of a tool, sets into motion action that, for the participants, they had no idea how this was going to turn out. They had no idea how to respond to the accident. And really, the bulk of Robbie's film occurs over about 9 or 10 hours in a minute by minute. I mean, the film isn't 10 hours long, but it's almost like a minute by minute examination of how people respond under pressure. Some of them do the wrong thing, and some of them are brave beyond belief.
And some of them had pretty good ideas what to do, and then were told not to do them by higher-ups.
The higher-ups had no idea what to do once we got off the checklist, as we were talking about earlier. So people really had no clue what was the right thing. But I think what's interesting is that the dropping of the socket was called a human error in the press or the Air Force the next few days afterwards. It was not the Air Force's problem. It was that someone made a mistake. But this turns out to not be the worst accident that week. There was another accident where a plane with 12 thermonuclear weapons caught on fire because someone forgot to put a little screw into where the gas comes out.
More human error.
It was called human error. The seat cushion, that was called human error. And as Eric says in the film, maybe it shouldn't be called human error when someone drops a socket by mistake and throws this incredibly powerful weapon into a field.
Obviously, there should have been more safety measures in place.
Well, the human error here is really building these machines in the first place.
How many were of these Titan II missile complexes were operating at the time?
We started out with 54, and there was an accident at another Titan II complex in Kansas, which knocked that one out of commission. So then there was only 53, and then the Damascus accident knocked that one out of commission, down to 52. But the missile that we had a lot of, we had about 1,000 of the Minuteman missiles, and it's a modern variant of that we have in the silos. As we're sitting here, there are about 440 Minuteman missiles scattered around Colorado, Wyoming, Nebraska, the Dakotas.
Aimed where?
Very good question. Right now, they don't have the targets in their guidance system. And if they're accidentally launched, they're supposed to just land in the ocean. But the reality is, the only country we can attack with these 440 missiles is Russia. Because where the silos are located and the range of these missiles, you'd either have to attack Russia or you'd have to fly over Russia to get to China. And I don't think the Russians would appreciate that. So these are a legacy of the Cold War, and
no wonder Vladimir Putin is getting involved in our election.
Yeah, well, But there,
although I can't imagine either of the candidates would want to send any of these missiles to Russia.
No, but there may be someone in the chain of command in one of these countries who might. And you know, one of the central points of the book, and I think of the film, is that every one of these weapons is an accident waiting to happen.
You also include many eyewitness accounts, from the man who dropped the socket to the man who designed the warhead to the Secretary of Defense. Was it difficult getting the participants to agree to be interviewed on camera?
Well, all of these, almost everybody in the film had been interviewed by Eric, but it's harder to interview someone on camera, I think, than it is to be interviewed for a book, which is a much more casual experience.
Any of them bitter?
Well, certainly the PTS, the workers who risked their lives that night and then, in effect, got thrown out of the Air Force, were very bitter.
Because it was their fault, the Air Force said.
A combination of their fault, a combination of them being thrown into a situation that was lethal when they weren't fully aware that it was lethal. And they were, the general was basically putting their lives at risk. And they were bitter about that, and they were bitter about how they were treated.
Didn't the former vice commander of the Strategic Air Command, General Lloyd Levitt, ignore your request for an interview? And should we be surprised considering how poorly SAC responded to the crisis?
Well, Eric,
I interviewed him for the book, and he didn't like it, and he threatened to sue me, and then he refused to talk to Robbie. But I hate to do this, but I'm going to give some great praise to Robbie while he's sitting here. What I do,
you need to do that.
I got to do it. What I do writing a book is I get to spend hours with people, hours with them, days with them, and then I condense it into my descriptions of them or the quote. But what Robbie has to do, and I was so impressed by it while watching him make this film, is he has to interview people while they're sitting on a set, perhaps for the first time in their lives, speaking to a camera for the first time in their lives with lights in their face, and then get them to talk about, some of the most important things that have happened in their life or the most traumatic thing that has happened in their lives. And there's been a lot of discussion about this film, about how it looks, how the silo looks, and some of the early reviews have talked about how realistic the depiction of this nuclear accident is. But for me, quite honestly, the most powerful parts of the film are these interviews with these ordinary guys, again, like 9/11 responders, who risked their lives on our behalf and then were mistreated. And it's really a testament to Robbie's interviewing skill that he was able to get them to forget their surroundings and just be completely truthful in the moment. And to me, that's the core, the emotional core of the film. And I think for people who see it, that's what they're really left with, isn't these bigger public policy issues, which are important, but a very human drama of ordinary people in jeopardy and how they experience it.
And some of them, their lives were changed forever because they were hospitalized, they had terrible burns.
And terrible trauma, mental trauma. Dave Powell had really, Dave Powell never told his mother about this accident until a few weeks ago when he went with her to see the movie. So these are things that they just blocked out of their lives. And Greg Devlin, who went back on his own into that silo and was blown to smithereens that night, has been on morphine ever since. They all loved the Air Force. They thought that was going to be their careers, and almost all of them left the Air Force after that. Soon thereafter that night.
And one of the things that the making of this film did, and look, I want lots of people to go see it. I think the film is very powerful and the subject's important, but even if none of that happens, one of the most meaningful things for me is that the making of this film provided a reason for these guys to get back together in the same place. I interviewed them separately. I went to go see them where they lived, but because of the needs of the way Robbie made the film, they flew to the same cities to be interviewed for the early screenings of the film. They showed up, and some of these guys hadn't seen one another in 30 years. Literally, some of them hadn't seen one another since the night of the accident. And the ability for these guys to get back together And the film honors their service. And on a personal level, that was one of the most meaningful things about this experience.
Although the Pentagon claims that the United States has had only 32 nuclear weapons accidents during the Cold War, that sounds like a lot to me. You suggest that the actual number is closer to 1,000?
Through the Freedom of Information Act, I got a document that said that between 1950 and 1968, there were more than 1,000 accidents and incidents involving nuclear weapons.
And anything so, like clearly, the one we're discussing here, the Damascus incident?
There were all kinds of serious accidents that don't appear on the Pentagon's official list of 32. And if you look at those 32 accidents, some of those, the official accidents, didn't even involve a warhead that was that had the nuclear material and could explode. But one of the most disturbing things is I got this big, thick document through the Freedom of Information Act, and I gave it to some of our top nuclear weapons designers who literally were responsible for the maintenance and the design of these nuclear weapons, and they had no idea that these accidents were occurring. This information had been kept from them, and it was part of the compartmentalized secrecy of the Cold War, in which the guys who were designing the weapons often didn't know how they were being handled in the field, and the guys who were handling them in the field didn't know safety issues. And that sort of intense secrecy actually made things much more dangerous.
But you mentioned in the film that the designers of the first atomic bomb worried about a nuclear detonation, the possibility that it might ignite the Earth's atmosphere and kill every living thing on the planet. But then they went ahead and tested the nuclear device anyway. Was that the most shocking thing that you discovered during your research?
Well, you know, they did the odds. They felt like the odds were against the atmosphere catching on fire. But there was one physicist who had been doing these calculations, Victor Weisskopf. He watched the detonation of the first nuclear device at Alamogordo, the Trinity test. He felt the intense heat on his face from a distance of about 10 miles. And even though he had been doing the calculations and he was a trained physicist, he believed the Earth's atmosphere had caught on fire and everything was about to be extinguished and die. So one of the themes is this profound risk has been present from the very beginning of the atomic age, and it continues to this day, whether we're willing to admit it or discuss it, and it needs much more attention today.
As Bob Purefoy, the man in charge of safety, who Eric had shown these document, Freedom of Information documents to, who had been unaware of them, says in the film, you know, that basically our safety has been brought about by luck. And luck is a bad policy. And, you know, I thought on some levels, Eric wrote a very comprehensive Command and Control is an amazing book, and it's much more comprehensive than our film. But I thought the Damascus incident is sort of the microcosm of everything that can go wrong as seen through one incident.
It's been pointed out that a small nuclear war between India and Pakistan involving about 100 weapons could kill more than a billion people. But one of the sadder moments, Harold Brown, who was Secretary of Defense at the time, said that after he learned that there had been neither an explosion nor any scattering of nuclear material, his level of attention went way down.
I think that's the scariest moment for me in the film, which is, as he said, he not only said his attention went down, he said, these things happen every day. And that's a terrifying statement. And, you know, he just moved on. And as we said earlier, in fact, this was not the worst accident that week.
This is the second film that you've made together. Do you have a...
We're not talking.
You don't talk now? Are you thinking of doing another one?
We were talking about this earlier. We've now done industrial agriculture and the misuse of workers and abuse of livestock and the threat of nuclear war. So I think great surfing beaches.
Yeah. Well, how about Miss America pageants?
I'll leave that one to you. I think great surfing. Just one thing about Harold Brown. Harold Brown was unusual as Secretary of Defense in that he was a physicist and a former weapons designer. So he really understood what could go wrong. And I don't agree with him on all of his political stances, but I think he really was a public servant, and that what's been so interesting for me meeting these guys is we were all afraid of nuclear war, you know, during the 80s, during the Cold War. So were the people in charge. And the people in charge had the enormous stress of living with this knowledge and doing their jobs.
But we were making movies at the time about Dr. Strangelove, yeah. And what was the other one?
The Day After.
There were a whole bunch. Yeah. And now nobody thinks twice about it, even though so much of our thinking involves Iran's possible nuclear program.
Well, I mean, just getting back
and
to...
And very quickly, because I'm running out of time.
Okay. I was just going to say, you know, Harold Brown said when he first saw a weapon go off, he read a newspaper for, you know, a few minutes. That's how powerful it was, from miles and miles, you know, 100 miles away or something.
Robert Kenner and Eric Schlosser will be doing Q&As after the 7 p.m. screenings of their film this Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday at the Film Forum. It's called Command and Control. Thank you both so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.
Thank you.